What feels very UCC? It's funny.
What feels UCC about
well,
it?
That feels like Riverside, the special poem like that goes out
pulpit.
A bit.
Yeah.
And then just the very, spare.
Yeah.
Feels comfy.
Well, which is funny because I grew up in a UCC congregation in Greenwich that was much more like Gothic.
Oh, really?
In style, like big stone columns, you know, stained glass windows all the way down, this massive, you know, it's so very
not
different.
Dunbar United.
Yeah.
But then of course Riverside, yes.
Right. Yeah. River. Yeah, but exactly. It was like UCC. it was like a little taste of Riverside.
Yeah.
Anyway, I gotta remember my intro. Okay, here we go. Friends, welcome to the Spring Glen Church podcast. I'm Reverend Jack Perkins Davidson, senior pastor of Spring Glen Church, as we do the next installation in the series we call Pastor Jack's Backpack, where I interview all the delightful, lovely authors in my proverbial backpack who are just awesome and brilliant and people that I know and love and trust, and am so excited today. Have Dr. Venezia Michelson to talk about her book Mothering and Desistance in Reentry, which we'll get more into what that means. But first, I wanted to start with a little bit of grounding for why this topic matters to us as Christians. And I'm thinking in particular about this, the story where Jesus talks about the sheep and the goats. And he says, nations, not just individuals, but entire nations will be judged based on how they treat the most vulnerable. And so he says, when, he lifts up the people who visited him when he was sick and when he was homeless and when he was hungry and when he was in prison. And they say, well, when did we do that? Jesus, for you, we don't remember doing that for you. And he says, when you did it for the least of these. And then he scorns the others and says, you know, I'm putting you over here, you goats, because you didn't visit me when I was sick and when I was homeless and when I was hungry and when I was naked and when I was in prison. And they said, when did we not do that for you? And he says, when you didn't do it for the least of these. Jesus explicitly names remembering those who are in prison and visiting them, being in community with them, loving them as your neighbor. As an essential piece of how we as nations will be judged at the end of times. Are we a just and loving society? And the rubric for that is how we treat those, even those who are in prison. Similarly, Jesus, we'll get to more. I have like three other mini sermons that I could preach right now. But yes. First, I want to get to Dr. Michelson. I'll read off her CV, is an associate professor of justice studies at Montclair State University in New Jersey, but a local resident here in Spring Glen and a friend of mine. Before coming to MSU, she worked at the Women's Prison Association, WPA, in New York City, an organization which provides direct services to women who have come into contact with the criminal justice system. I love that phrasing, who have come into contact with the criminal justice system, which sort of highlights some of the things we're going to be talking about today, that this is a very broad category of people that we're talking about. And there's lots of different ways that women are harshly impacted by the criminal justice system. She earned her BA at Barnard College and her PhD in criminal justice with a focus on women and justice from the CUNY Graduate Center. So welcome, Dr. Michelson. I'm so glad that you are here.
Thank you.
And so glad to be talking about this book, Mothering and Desistance in Reentry, which came out in 2019.
A while ago now, yeah.
Just a few years ago. Like another universe ago, like an alternate reality. But I think we're going to start with very basic, bring us up to speed, because, some of these words are obvious, but they're also like sort of very buzzword, you have to sort of be in the culture, in the system or in the study in some ways to sort of get the connotations here. So what is desistance? What is reentry? And even what is mothering?
Yeah, I wondered if you would do that one too. That's good. Add that one in there. So we'll start with we'll start with desistance. So traditionally in the study of criminal behavior, so-called criminal behavior, people have focused on the issue of recidivism, which is whether or not after someone gets into trouble with the criminal justice system, do they come out and then commit crime again, which is obviously by definition, it's a failure. Normally associated with the individual, but really it has to do with the system as much as it does with the individual, if not more. Desistance is the process by which people stop or slow criminal behavior. So it's instead of looking at the failure, desistance is the slowing down or the stopping.
So recidivism is like you got caught again.
Yes.
Desistance is more about the person's behavior.
Yes. And you know, when we talk about recidivism, what you said is important. It's you got caught again, because it's much more difficult to measure whether or not someone committed a crime again. People commit crimes all the time, right? Constantly. People are right out there committing crimes right now, texting and driving, or grabbing something at the supermarket that they don't pay for, whatever it is, right? People are committing crimes constantly, but whether or not they get caught is another issue, right? So recidivism, the measure of recidivism is usually a measure of whether or not they get caught again, which of course is problematic in all these different reasons, because once you get out, you're being watched more. If you're on parole, you're getting watched more than somebody else, right? You have to drop urine where somebody else doesn't. And you're both smoking weed, but one person is more likely to get caught than the other. So all of these are problematic because of measurement. But so recidivism is whether or not you get caught again for committing another crime after you've been in trouble for the first time.
Or just, you know, some failure of the system's stringent rules on you for reentry. You fail to meet those, right?
Right.
It's not even like I've committed a crime, but recidivism is like you failed to show up 5 minutes early, and so you're going back in.
And parole is a trap for that very reason. Mm-hmm. And that also, of course, depends on who your parole officer is and whether or not they're having a good day or a bad day, right? So there's all of these wiggly woggly reasons why you might end up getting in trouble again.
The reason
that I like to focus on desistance is because it's much more subtle. And you know, for both, you can use self-report, right? Ask somebody. It's not just, did you get arrested? It could be like, hey, what's happened in the past month or what's happened in the past week or whatever. But desistance also takes into account the fact that people sometimes slow criminal behavior after they've gotten in trouble the first time. It might not be a cold turkey, or maybe it's a cold turkey and then it starts again and then it stops again. That's the reality of life. And that if we're just going to be sort of focused on whether or not somebody fails again and then they're irredeemable, then, you know, we're just buying into this totally failed system.
Well, and then in your definition of desistance, you said stop or slow or like reduce, right?
Yes.
And that's so interesting, because I think we tend to think of criminals, quote unquote, in sort of black and white terms, both race and also sort of yes and no
indeed.
Terms, right? Binary, right? Like either you're a criminal and then you stop, or, you know, not, right? Like,
well, and then you're still a criminal, but yes, it's a question of whether you've fixed yourself. And,
right. But it leaves some space for recognizing progress, right? Like, oh, you're not selling, you know, you're not doing this as much, right?
And, you know, it's the reality for literally everyone, right? Everyone, I mean, you know, maybe there's one or two, but basically, you know, the most clear determinant of criminal behavior is age. Because pretty much everyone, as they age, crime goes down. So we all desist, even those of us who haven't gotten caught,
right?
It peaks in sort of early mid-teens, you know, sometimes to the early 20s, but then it just goes down. There's a small number of people for whom it stays so-called career criminals. We don't call them that anymore. Well, some people do. But, you know, it's this idea of people who sort of criminal things that are against the law are their way of making a living, for example. So it's something that they do across their lifespan, but it's a very small number of people. And frankly, to go off into policy, if we were to simply focus on those people who are sort of chronic recidivists, if you will, who aren't desisting, where everybody else is going down, these people are not desisting, you focus on that small group of people instead of focusing on everyone, then you would use really small number of resources to impact a huge number of crimes. And this is old stuff. You know, this is stuff that was going in Philly decades ago, research that was going on decades and decades ago at this point. So anyway, desistance, sort of focused on most of all by theorists named Sampson and Laub, who looked at people over their life course and looked at how crime changed over time. So my focus on desistance does have to do with sort of realizing that things are not as black and white, if you will, as you say, not as dichotomous as you say, that they're much more complicated, which is my theme always in my career. and also that, you know, change is hard and people are human beings and we have to accept that. And it can't just be, you made this mistake and now you're written off forever. Right. So there's desistance. Reentry in this context is once someone has been incarcerated in prison or jail, and there's a difference just for people who don't know, jail is in general for either people who have not yet been convicted of a crime, so being held, they couldn't make bail or they weren't given bail, or people who have been convicted of a crime that got a sentence of less than a year, generally a misdemeanor. So a jail is somewhere it's much more local. There's much more turnover. There's much more churning of people in and out, in and out, in and out. Whereas a prison, you have to have been convicted for the most, you know, except for small exceptions, you've been convicted of something. You can't just be held there. And it's a conviction of more than a year. So these are places that are generally even farther out from communities. And they are places where people stay for longer periods of time. People sort of, you know, really getting entrenched in living there.
Which is funny because I think of reentry usually as applying to people who are in prison long term. Yeah. But to your framing of like, oh, yeah, also people in jail, whether it's one night or 6 months or a year, like they're still, it's still it's still a coming home. It's still a like reconnecting to society in important ways.
Yeah. And nuanced, and it's different, not even nuanced, like it'll smack you in the face with the differences, right? You're in jail for one night, you wouldn't necessarily have not been able to pay the rent, right? Your landlord wouldn't have necessarily known you were gone. Your job wouldn't have necessarily, you could call in sick and you're in there for one night. It's not a big deal. 1 month, totally different. Even 1 week, totally different. 1 month, completely different. 6 months, completely different, right. Let alone 10 years, right?
Like one week could even lose you your job,
absolutely.
Right? One night could even lose
you. And depending
your job.
On when you lose it, you might not have paid the bills and something got shut off or DCF comes along and takes your kids, right? Like all sorts of things can change. And everybody just thinks like, okay, they go to prison and then they come back and that's it. But reentry is much more complicated than that. But so when someone is incarcerated in prison or jail, reentry is the process by which they come back into their communities. And reentry is hugely multifaceted. I was very, very lucky to be able to work at the Women's Prison Association for a number of years to watch women in reentry at all stages, right? So, you know, go to Rikers or Rikers is obviously the jail in New York City, or go to some of the prisons that were there, Bedford Hills, Taconic, for example, which were a little bit out of the city. And as women were preparing for reentry, anybody who does reentry should know that reentry planning should begin the second that you enter the doors of the facility, right? You need to start planning for your release because, you know, you're in a holding pattern right now. Sometimes people get much longer sentences, but still good reentry planning starts the second that you get in. And you have to think, again, at WPA, we put together this thing called the Success in the Community Matrix. Mm-hmm. And it reminded people that success in the community has to go across what we call the domains. You know, it was housing. It was the ability to support yourself financially. It was family. It was even, you know, sort of being a part of a community, that all of these things, first of all, and then along the side, you know, I can give a link to this to you because it's very helpful to look at it, that reentry happens, what you need when you first get out, right? Because when women would come out from Rikers, they'd have a big garbage bag full of their stuff. Huh. And then they would come in and grab some cans of food and some sanitary products and some toothpaste, right? What you need at that moment.
The immediate.
Yes, is completely different from the intermediate and the long term and all of these phases in between. So you know, what happens in reentry is incredibly complicated, incredibly difficult. Add to that, so here we are putting my title together, right? So you've got reentry and desistance. So with all of that, trying to find a place to live, trying to find a way to get some money, trying to figure out where the heck your kids are or whether they want a relationship with you or how to get them to school or what's going on with them, right? How to, you know, make it so that you actually want to get up in the morning? What about substance use, right? Are you in treatment? What's going on with your treatment? What if you need medical care? Do you have your prescriptions? All of these things. Within all of that, you have to try not to commit crime again.
Yeah.
When often, especially for women, and here we get to the mothering part of the title, when it comes to women, often those crimes are crimes of survival. There are crimes of survival that are, we may not call them survival, but for these women, they are survival. There's a woman named Taylor Nouvelle, and she talks about the trauma to prison pipeline. She herself is formerly incarcerated. She's an incredible activist in DC. And I'll give you a link to her stuff because it's important to give her credit for what she's done.
Yeah.
You know, but she talks about trauma to prison pipeline, and so many crimes that people commit are women in particular are related to domestic violence that they've suffered, childhood abuse that they've suffered. There's a theory called pathways theory that talks about how women's crime is most often rooted in abuse that starts with abuse in the home.
Yeah.
And then they are trying to survive. So they do things like running away or truancy from school, which if you're a juvenile are crimes, they're status offenses. So then they get criminalized for trying to survive in a difficult home.
Yeah.
Once you get criminalized for that, well, what are you going to do? Then you're in trouble already. So you're labeled as somebody who's in trouble. So then you're going to do what? I mean, a lot of people are going to get high,
yeah,
right? And then you try start to get high. You're trying to escape. You're trying to self-medicate. Once you're trying to get high, you have to find a way to support that habit. So maybe you're shoplifting. Maybe you're engaging in some sort of behavior with, often there's a male who's sort of more in charge, and the woman sometimes often ends up getting the same sentence as the man, even though she's not even as involved.
Yeah.
Or you're getting involved in sex work, right? And then you're sort of deeper in and deeper in and deeper in. And often then they are victims in domestic violence situations. And then we've taken these people that we care so much about when they're kids, right? These kids, oh my God, we can't, you know, there's human trafficking and the kids are being prostituted. We care about them so much when they're babies and when they're kids. And then there's some transition point somewhere along the line where all of a sudden they're criminals and we need to lock them up. So, you know, where the mothering comes in is that women in particular, not that only women are mothers, but in this book, I focus on women who are mothers, who are dealing with all of this trauma and all of this pathway that they've gone along, this pipeline that they've gone along. And you add kids to this mix. And then the last thing I'll say related to this, the original question, is that when men are incarcerated, almost always when fathers are incarcerated, almost always the mother is the one who takes care of the children. He goes away, she takes the kids are in her care. There's very little, not very little transition for them, but in terms of their housing, in terms of all of these different things, there's a lot more stability. When women go away, it's much more rare that the father takes care of the children. The kids are much more likely to go to female family members like grandmothers, like aunts, like sisters. And DCF, you know, involvement with the child welfare system is much more common when it comes to mothers, and termination of parental rights, even where kids get adopted by somebody else, is much more common for women. So that disruption, right? How does that relate? And my question with this book was, I'll tell you, I did the research before I was a mother myself, and wrote and then ended up writing the book once I had become a mother. And, you know, it was a very interesting transition for me.
Yeah, yeah. And your understanding.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And so the question is, how does the fact that kids are so much more central to these moms in the mom's lives, not to say that fathers aren't important and don't love their kids, but in the kids are so much more central to the lives of these moms, how does that impact whether or not they go back to criminal behavior once they're coming out into the community after their incarceration?
Well, I mean, what you talk about in this book too is the vast difference in study on this topic, that there's a lot of conversation about men and recidivism and desistance, and there's not a lot on women and motherhood and how that impacts that. And so I really appreciate your taking this on, and I really love this. When I first reached out to you about doing this interview, was assuming that the book would be this thick academic, you know, thing that I'd have to wade through and parse out it. But this is like really this is like almost a pop read. Like you maintain the like depth and sincerity of academic study and rigor, but you made it super accessible. Like
I
flew through this book. It was really enjoyable because you paired your sort of academic study with your interviews and with sort of real anecdotes and quotes from women. Yeah. And you sort of get, you give a really beautiful picture of who these women are rather than just treating them as abstract data.
Yeah.
So the thing that you started to touch on there a few minutes ago was the sort of labeling. You know, we tend to think of criminals over here and victims over here.
Yes.
And that's one thing I really appreciated about your book is the way you complicate that. And those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive.
They're almost never.
Identities.
Yeah.
Even when you were just saying before, like, oh yeah, if you text and drive, you're a criminal. Like that's, you know, right. We might say like that's questionable behavior, but I don't think anybody would be like, oh yeah, that's a criminal behavior. And yeah. So these categories of criminal and victim are just, it's interesting to think of that trauma to prison pipeline yep. that you were talking about. Would you like say, can you say, talk more about that sort of criminal and victimhood of women?
Yeah, well, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, one important place to start is to look at something that we call critical criminology, which is, you know, when I teach criminology textbooks and, you know, criminology classes focus almost completely on all these different categories of theories about what's wrong with people mm-hmm. that they break the law.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? Is it because their parents didn't teach them self-control? Is it because they have some sort of biological thing going on, too much testosterone, some extra chromosome? Is it because they make choices in this direction? But there's all of these millions of theories about this. I have some favorite ones. I love strain theory, you know, which talks about how negative emotions lead to strain that lead to crime, right? You're worried you're going to lose your boyfriend, so you punch somebody in the face, whatever, right? So there's all these really interesting theories about what's wrong with people that they commit crime. Sometimes it's poverty, sometimes it's structural stuff, but it's still about why are they breaking the law? Critical criminology comes along and says, who made the laws? Mm. Why did they make the laws? How are they maintaining their power by creating such laws and keeping other people out of power by creating such laws, right? I'm reminded of there was an interview done with one of Nixon's aides where he was like, yeah, we created these laws against heroin and marijuana because we knew that the hippies and the black people weren't going to vote for us. So we created these laws, and it's on tape. It's, you know, it's very clear. So why
explicitly saying this was a political maneuver?
Absolutely. Wow. Right. And the laws happen that way all the time. I mean, think about sex offender laws.
Yeah.
Sex offender laws are completely ineffective.
Yeah.
Not just that. They are counterproductive when it comes to sex offenses, but they make us feel good because they make us feel like we're doing something with registries, right? We can look somebody up and be like, oh, that's the bad guy over there.
Right.
Or, oh, they can't live this close to a school, or, oh, they can't do this, or they can't do that. But then all of a sudden you've given somebody, frankly, almost always with a sex abuse history of their own, you've given them this teensy weensy little spot where they can live underneath a bridge. Literally in Florida, there was a place where people had to sort of congregate under a bridge. It was the only place they could live.
Wow.
And what do you think they're going to do?
Right.
They're going to be far more likely to reoffend. So the question of critical criminology is, who made the laws and why did they make the laws? And what can we do to try to sort of redistribute power? Obviously, these things are going to sound very familiar, these ideas, but this is how criminology has looked at it. So a lot of, you know, when we talk about this overlap between so-called criminal and victim, it really, if you look at the statistics, you know, let alone the stories, like the stories that I heard and the stories we hear all the time. If you look at the statistics, almost everyone, especially women who are incarcerated, have histories of trauma.
Yeah.
Let alone that prison itself is absolutely incredibly traumatic experience that only encourages recidivism. Our recidivism rate here in the United States is abysmally high, right? Almost everyone goes back within a relatively short amount of time. But that instead of addressing the core issues of victimization, or frankly, preventing victimization in the first place, we've decided to create these cages to throw everybody away and so that we can forget that they exist. And then when they come out, they have very little supports, or supports that are not proven to work or are not implemented in a way that is effective, even though they could be effective. And then we get angry when they fail, you know, and we're not addressing the fact that trauma is an absolutely huge part of why they're in there in the first place and why when they get out, having to deal with all of those different domains that I talked about, let alone the family disruption and people who are upset with you, or you can't live with them because you have a felony conviction and they're in public housing or whatever, all of these millions of complications, you know, and then we get upset when they want to get high.
Well, then, you know, thinking about that differential to your naming about the women tending to be the sort of primary caregiver,
yes,
and the, right, so that it disrupts the family home more. Like there's a systemic issue there as well in, yes, terms of like, I imagine this is my hypothesis, having not done the research, so correct me if I'm wrong, but like, you know, like the war on drugs being the beginning of sort of mass incarceration, putting so many fathers behind jail, right, yeah, behind bars,
yep,
in prison, and sort of starting that as a trend, right? That there's this idea of like, oh, fathers, you know, especially like racist ideas about like black fathers are, yep, never there.
Yep.
Shame on black fathers, but it was really a white system that put that in place and made that sort of the norm.
Yes.
So, you know, the sort of like, it seems like it's an onion. Like you just keep adding layers and complications and systemic issues.
Versus... I'm very annoying to have a conversation with for somebody who really likes prison or jail, because they keep coming up with things like, well, okay, but it works for this. And they're like, actually, no, it doesn't work for that at all. And then they'll try something else. And no, it doesn't work for that either. And no, it doesn't work for that either.
It, you know, just makes us feel good as the people who are not directly impacted by it.
Right. And frankly, even for people who are directly impacted, I think it sort of ends up being this very visceral feeling of like, put them away or punish them, right? I think it's, in the end, it is relatively human emotion. But again, as I said earlier, it's a question of what works versus what makes us feel better.
Right. I mean, you see that in the current twist in politics,
yes,
right now, where there's a lot of that on the national and the very hyper local for us,
yes,
here,
indeed,
in Hamden,
yep,
of this, what I am guessing is a false narrative, because there's the data isn't released yet about a supposed increase in crime. And there was even data released recently that said that's actually false. It's been declining
for a lot
in the last decade.
For some things, yep. Well, I mean, massively.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
crime has
plummeted massively, except there's certain categories. I just want to interrupt you now.
Go.
You know, yes, we've had all sorts of crime declines. Are there rashes of cars getting stolen? Of course, there's rashes of cars getting stolen.
Yeah.
Like, yes. Or cars getting rifled through. Lock your cars. Sorry. It's called target hardening. Like, lock your cars. But, you know, or create after school activities or you know, create situations in which kids want to be home.
Yeah.
Right. Often kids don't want to be home. Mm-hmm. So they go somewhere else and they want to have some fun. They're kids, just like I was a kid, just like you were,
yeah,
a kid. You know, but there are, you know, one of the things, speaking about women in particular, you know, one crime that we do a very, very, very bad job of measuring, and that, you know, probably is really sky high, is domestic violence, intimate partner violence, and obviously sexual assault as well.
Yeah.
Crimes against women in particular in the home.
Yeah.
We worry so much about somebody hiding in an alleyway and you know, hiding to sexually assault someone or steal our children.
Right.
That's not where your kids are in danger. That's not where your family members are in danger, where women are in danger. You're in danger in a home.
Mm.
You know, homes are where it's dangerous, and COVID brought that up for a lot of people. It was,
yeah,
incredibly stressful. It was incredibly difficult. And we have no idea what ended up happening. So, you know, okay, fine. You worry about your car getting rifled through, but, you know, really we need to worry about extending kindness and compassion to people who are in incredibly difficult situations, with income being lost, jobs being lost, time in the home that they weren't expecting,
yeah,
nothing to do,
yeah,
bills piling up, right? And then people lash out at the people around them.
Hmm. Man, you just made me really depressed.
Sorry.
No, this is what we're here to talk about, because that's, you know, so many circumstances where women need help but instead get criminalized, or, you know, where they need support, they need to be sort of cared for and find healing, and instead they get, that's one thing you talk a lot about in your book, is the tendency or the trend towards punishment, right? So that,
yes,
the false political narrative we were just talking about like, there's so much crime now, we have to increase patrols, and or we're being too lenient on teenagers, and
right,
so, you know, there's that push for punishment.
Yes.
And it sounds like in your book that your research has found that that's actually like does the opposite, and you know, and that there are better ways for us to intervene.
Well, you know, it's complicated, yeah. Right? There are some situations and some people for whom punishment works. I have a dear friend, Yolanda Johnson Peterkin, who does incredible work right now. She's with housing in New York City, but I worked with her at Women's Prison Association. She's formerly incarcerated herself. She swears by boot camp. She says boot camp changed her life.
What's boot camp?
Boot camp, like, so instead of going in for a prison term, or, you know, can shorten your prison term by going to this very intense, like a military type of thing. She swears by it. And, you know, whenever I would have her speak to my classes, I'd be like, oh God, she's going to talk about boot camp, and she loves it, and it worked for her, but it doesn't mean it works for everybody. It actually doesn't work for a lot of people, you know, but like we have to be more thoughtful about what works, that punishment is going to work for some people. In fact, it's the oldest thought of criminology is Beccaria. In the 1700s, he wrote a book called On Crimes and Punishments. Okay. And he said, swift, certain, but not severe.
Yeah.
Right. So it has to, it's like, you know, parenting. It has to happen right away.
Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, you've detached from the, right.
It has to be certain. They have to know that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's going to happen each time. But if you do it too severe, he's actually against the death penalty as non-functional.
Yeah.
You know, if it's too severe, then people aren't going to think it's going to happen. So, you know, that, well, if we're talking about domestic violence, you were talking about criminalizing and, you know, sort of punishing. Policing actually doesn't do a good job with domestic violence cases at all. And what we find is that when there are different types of approaches to this, right, that we want to send in the cops, and it doesn't work for literally anyone. It doesn't work for the people who are in this situation in terms of the victims. It doesn't happen for the people who are victimizing. And frankly, it doesn't happen for the cop. It doesn't work for the cops because they don't know what they're doing.
Well, and
they don't have the training.
Many of the cops I know and talk to say it is literally the most dangerous situation that they can get involved with.
Mm-hmm. And they don't know what to do that works. Yeah. Right. And so that's one of the reasons, you know, some of the discussion that's happening around here in town and also nationally is bringing in social workers so that instead of sending just cops who have very little training, a lot of firearms training, but very little training when it comes to de-escalation, you know, short trainings, but not nearly enough, you know, bringing in somebody who is a social worker and can actually do that de-escalation, can, you know, and maybe down the line do some sort of restorative practices, though that, again, complicated because it doesn't always work.
Right. So we're talking a lot about the going into prison part so far.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I'm sure there's plenty to talk about the actual in prison incarceration.
Yes. Traumatic. Piece.
Talk to me about the coming out part. There were some interesting stories in there that you shared about like women who were actually sort of nervous to come back, not sure they were ready to reconnect with their children. You know, talk me through the experience of reentry for women. Yeah. What hurdles are there? What you talked about the matrix, which I saw in the book and thought really helped make things clear. But what are the pitfalls? What's unique to being a woman and a mother coming out of prison? What's, you know, what is that experience like?
Yeah. So to preface, I have not been incarcerated.
Yes.
Right? And I am, I certainly have all sorts of people that I know who have been incarcerated, but I have not had that experience. So I'm sort of, you know, lucky to be able to be channeling the stories of these people that I spoke to. I feel like two of the most important things that came out of the work that I was doing with these women, the research that I was doing and interviews that I did with these women is, first of all, while women were, I'm going to rewind just slightly if you don't mind.
Do it.
While women were inside, one of the most unexpected things that I found was women were sort of like, well, okay, so prison's horrible and I hated it and it was, you know, disgusting and awful. But I actually got a little break. I got to like sit down and get to know myself a little bit more. And I got to, for the most part, people got to be sober, you know, and sit down and have this time, which is one of the reasons why the article that preceded this book was called A Cell of One's Own, right? Which for me, I called it that because, you know, I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again. You know, I got to go, as you said, to Barnard College, right? Yeah. And when I wanted to sort of get to know myself, I had a dorm room of my own, usually. And I got to, you know, sit there and figure out who I was and what I wanted. And I didn't have kids yet. And I got to have this time to myself. But for, you know, I remember sitting down, one of my mentors is a woman, a professor named Jean Fleven up at Fordham in the sociology department. I was like, Jean, what am I going to do? These women are talking about prison as actually being, you know, I thought kids were going to be it. Right. Like they talked about, you know, okay, I'm desisting, you know, and I was like, okay, well, it's kids, right? You love your kids so much. And they were like, actually, I love my kids. But I got to like go inside and figure out that I didn't want this for my life. Hmm. And I got to be sober and I got to figure out like, oh God, you know, this is not what I want for myself. So, and I was like, is prison good? You know, like, oh God. But then, you know, we talked through it and what I came to is this, we have failed as a society. Hmm. If for poor, traumatized, victimized Black and brown women, this is the place that they have to end up in order to get to a place of redemption or desistance or wanting to be better or wanting to be like, how in the world have we gotten to such a deep, dark, desperate place that this is where women go to find themselves?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
to become better mothers or to figure out all these things. And then that flows into, okay, so let's say you go inside and you figure out like, whoa, right? There was a story in there about a woman who was face down in the mud with a cop's like knee on her back or something like that. And she was like, okay, this is rock bottom.
Yeah.
Don't want this again.
Right.
And then goes inside and then prison is just, you know, all sorts of horrible for a lot of different reasons. But then you come out and you may have all of these incredible intentions, right? Mm. I mean, you know, I read a book by Brené Brown and then, you know, I'm ready to come, you know, or Matthew, right? I mean, maybe I read Matthew, right?
Yeah.
You know, but I go, you know, and then I have all these intentions, but then you hit a brick wall of you have no job training, you have no support, your kids often hate you because you were gone and maybe you stole from them or maybe you treated them badly and then you were gone. And so you're facing, you know, you're sitting there. I think I have a story in the book about a woman who was like, I just want to paint my nails with my girl, like my daughter. I'm going to come out and paint my nails. And then you get out and your daughter's like, ew, don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah.
How do you cope with that? Frankly, you get high, right? Like, how do you cope with not having a job, needing to find a place, needing to comply with your parole sanction, you know, sort of rules and restrictions? Yeah. Having to, you know, drop urine as a part of that, right? Like, make sure you're not getting high. Like, who could do that?
Yeah.
And it's incredibly
exhausting to me.
It's exhausting, let alone.
And I have all the stability that you're naming.
And you just went from a place that is regimented in all of these different ways with people that sometimes you've known for a very, very, very long time.
Right.
And you've gotten used to this, then you come out. And I was talking to women in New York City, some of whom went in when they were tokens. And now there's a Metro card when you want to ride the subway, right?
Wow.
Everything's changed on the map. All these buildings are different. All of these things are different. If you've been in for a long time, again, seeing again why treating people coming out of prison versus treating people coming out of jail the same makes absolutely no sense.
But yeah. right?
If you've been in for 1 week versus if you've been in for 10 years or longer.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely worried about coming out. You don't know anybody anymore. Women are much less likely to get visits. If going back to your opening, you know, sort of mini sermon, you know, women are far less likely to get visits for a variety of reasons. That because there are fewer women, there are fewer facilities, and those facilities are farther away. Mm. Right. I mean, Albion Correctional Facility is at the Canadian border. Right. So, you know, women who, you know, and grandma, it's not mom taking care of the kids. It's grandma taking care of the kids. So what's grandma going to do? Take them on a flight?
Yeah.
You know, she's almost certainly on public assistance. She's got these kids that she needs to take care of. She's older. And then once you get to a visit, visits can be incredibly traumatic. You know, depending on how they're doing all these things. With COVID, it was made even worse because there were no visits.
Right.
Which,
so that's a whole year and a half of life that you've missed out on.
Yeah. And I mean, if I sound like I'm doing a laundry list, it's because I'm doing a laundry list.
Because it
and
is,
it could just keep going. And there's sheets and there's towels and there's shirts and there's underwear and there's all the, like, there's so much laundry to do. And that's how exhausting it is.
Well, and there's, you know, I was part of a program when I was in divinity school that we went in and tried to like have relationships and connections with people, and the process that I had to go through, that just anybody had to go through, even assuming that it's close enough, you can get there in a zip car or on a train or on a bus, right? Like, even if you're able to access it, the process to get in is like, just like think of extreme, airport security, right? And if any one little detail is off, they
don't
like
a red shirt on the day that you're not supposed to wear a red shirt.
Exactly. If you're wearing the wrong kind of pants, if there's holes in your pants, if the guard just doesn't like you,
or had a bad day,
or something goes wrong in the prison unrelated to the person you're visiting, and they have to shut down in order to control it, and you just traveled 3 hours to not be able to see the person, right? It's so
when
hard.
We know that one of the most important factors in whether or not someone is successful in reentry is their relationships and how strong their relationships are. So it's an active sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Like bombing of what would make somebody successful. If you're making visits more difficult, phone calls more difficult, emails more difficult, because you can email from tablets, but of course it costs all sorts of money, that's going to a corporation. But letters more difficult, right? Making all of these ways more difficult that actually are proven over decades of research are proven to make people more successful, not just when they get out, but also when they are inside, right? Fewer infractions while they're inside, and then more successful reentry on the outside.
Sense of humanity.
And you're failing at doing that simple thing.
Well, what you said earlier has really stuck with me, that idea that the most successful reentry plan starts as soon as the person goes in.
Yes.
Which is such a funny phrasing, because it's like, isn't that supposed to be the whole point of, in a restorative justice version of prison,
or rehabilitation, if we're talking about rehabilitation.
Even, right? Mm-hmm. Like certainly there's a level of like, we need to remove you and punish you because you've done a bad thing.
Yeah,
and
accountability. Against accountability.
But then when accountability, quote unquote, just becomes punishment for punishment's sake, because we think that's what we're supposed to do.
And for money making.
Private prisons are a whole other. We need like five podcast episodes about
this.
Ones. Right?
The public ones are incredibly money making.
Right. Or like, the phone calls has been a big thing. Like Connecticut did that. That
we
just
did,
passed, right?
Yeah. Made them free for state.
And
mention.
Are we the first state to make phone calls free for prisoners? Which, on the one hand, if it's just so baffling that you disconnect people from their community and then charge them to have the ability to connect to
while
their
we're
people.
Paying them pennies an hour,
right, for prison
and
labor.
So therefore, the families on the outside are the ones that are paying, right? Like, if anybody's worried about taxpayers, it is the taxpayers that are paying. It's the people on the outside who are already poor. Anyway, sorry. Yes.
Well, and we're sort of skirting around some racial justice topics there too. Right, there's been a lot of conversation in the public arena about, the 13th Amendment and how slavery didn't actually end. It just turned into mass incarceration.
Yes.
And talk to me about the racial dynamics of your study, because I believe in one section in your methodology chapter, you talked, I think it was 75% of the women you talked to were Black.
Yes.
Is that representative of the racial differences, or is that just who you were able to talk to?
Well, always with sampling methods, and I use a snowball sampling method that, doesn't make my sample representative statistically at all. But however, our prisons are absolutely overrepresented with Black and Brown people, both men and women. Mm. And, I do want to say, if we're talking about the 13th Amendment and the fight to sort of end that exception, if people are interested, the organization named Worth Rises and the woman who runs it, Bianca Tylek, Bianca worked with me and a couple of other people. Bianca spearheaded the effort for free phone calls here in Connecticut. And she's incredible, absolute amazing advocate, tireless, resourceful, fearless, amazing work that she's doing now to fight to end the exception on a national level. Mm. So if anybody's interested, you want to act, they will give you ways to act on that. But in terms of racial justice, like, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about critical criminology and the ways in which we people in power make the laws to stay so that they can stay in power. And so much of that is racialized. And it's ended up, yes, there's a direct line from slavery to Jim Crow to mass incarceration. You know, the book The New Jim Crow does a beautiful job. And there was a relatively maybe a year or two ago, a recent update to that having to do with just in the New York Times, like a column in the New York Times about incarceration and the ways in which, you know, mass incarceration is shifting along with the times to make sure that it continues to make money, right? But we absolutely, you know, people, you know, crime rates do change according to race and according to poverty, but overwhelmingly our prisons and jails are filled with Black and Brown people in ways that do not mirror crime patterns, or even more importantly, harm patterns, right? So if we're talking about, for example, white collar crime, the mass impact of criminal activity, harmful activity, in order to make money,
right?
You know,
millions and billions of dollars.
And harm, just pure pain and harm that things like that cause. You know, overwhelmingly more, if you could measure harm, which I'm sure social scientists we can figure that out. But you know, measuring harm, but we choose to criminalize and focus on certain crimes that make sure that our prisons continue to be filled with Black and Brown people.
Quick shout out to the people in our church who fight white crime or white collar crime. So we have a couple of those folks. So
yay is it them. White crime or white collar crime?
White crime. Yeah, it's both probably.
that was pretty good.
So, I mean, you know, there's one point where you talk about, we mentioned the war on drugs a little bit earlier, but there's a framing that you put on it that's really fascinating in this book, because often you think about the war on drugs criminalizing Black men and putting them in prison, but you talked about it as a war on women, the war on drugs as a war on women.
Yes.
Talk me through that.
I mean, you know, there's also, you have to think about, when it comes to women, you have to think about the dual impact of this criminalization. On the one hand, as I said before, about criminalization of survival strategies, right? It's how drugs can be a way for people with trauma to manage their trauma and deal with their trauma, right? To sort of try to survive through something. And that by criminalizing it, we're ignoring that trauma, and we're ignoring that they're really trying to help themselves. Mm. So that's, and given that women are so impacted by trauma, especially women in the criminal justice system are so impacted by trauma, that's a war on that. But then on the other hand, you know, when you, Todd Clear and Dina Rose talked in their research a number of years ago about something called coercive mobility, which is what you were talking before about, you know, removing fathers from a community. And that, this sort of mass incarceration movement was a way to coercively remove people and move them in and out of their communities, in and out, this again with a churning, right? This movement that's so disruptive, it makes for communities and human beings who don't have these roots, right? Here we are in Spring Glen, right? Yeah. A community known for being able to have stability. It's one of the reasons why people come here. It's neighborhoods and it's homes, and it's, you know, that guy down the street who does the crazy skeletons, you know, decorations. I don't even know who they are, but the decorations are, and everybody watches for them, and we always get to complain about whether bulk trash is late, and we get to, right, like, you know, and we know that you're going to be here and Best Video is going to be there, right? Like all of these things that are so stable and are so sort of can be comforting to people when we keep removing people. Imagine this neighborhood if all of a sudden people were just disappearing all the time, and then they were coming back, and then they were disappearing, and then they were coming back. That lack of stability is so, well, it's destabilizing, right? And it impacts so much. And that women are the ones that remain on the outside trying to hold it down in all of these different ways and doing it, frankly, particularly good job at it, because they are visiting the men that are inside, and they are writing letters, and they are making these phone calls and putting on, you know, money onto people's commissary accounts so that if they want, you know, a $10, you know, mac and cheese or something like that, they can get it.
I'm sorry, commissary a $10?
Well, you know, honestly, it's probably way more expensive than that. Yeah, I'm not on my commissary prices, but there's corporations, Securus, for example, making money off of commissary,
right?
You know, so
which is like
things that people
the
need.
The idea of making money off of anything in prison is just baffling
for
me.
You. For Tom Gore as a Securus, it makes perfect sense. For Aramark, frankly, for all of these companies that we know very, very well, that, you know, unironically, right, they provide services to schools and they provide them to prisons, right? And it's sort of the same stuff and the same money that, well, they're making more money off of prisons, but still, you know, you got an app on your phone and every single time you want to put money on somebody's account, there's all of these extra fees, and this not just corporations but also the state is making money.
Right. And it's you know, there's no, for people who are fans of the free market, right? Like, there's no free market there, right? Yes. You're stuck. You have one choice. Yes. It's a monopoly. So pull us into some hope in the end here.
Always.
I was, you know, saying that that's the nice thing about your book, right? Like, a lot of times people will, especially in sort of academic analysis, will just like leave you with the problem, right? Like, just we're just here to analyze the problem, right? Yeah. But you actually end on like, these are very attainable things that we could do instead, or places we can intervene. I think in one part you talked about like the reentry moment, right? That first day after getting out is like the most important day to intervene, because it's the most vulnerable time, but it also has been shown in some studies that you cited that it's like the like crucial determinant about somebody who goes back in and somebody who finds success in the community, as the chart says.
Yeah, you know, the Vera Institute of Justice did some now classic research on that those first few days are the most important time. Absolutely. So focusing on people when they first get out, recognizing that, you know, you think they're scary, but they're actually just terrified the way that you would be terrified and worried and all these things, right? Humanizing. So much of this is about humanizing. Yes, they've done things wrong. Yes, you're angry at them. Yes, they may do things wrong again. But if we don't help them and help them quickly to get to a place where they feel comfortable and get to a place where they can satisfy their needs and their wants, eventually their wants as well, then they're just going to go right back inside.
Right.
And those crime rates that you're so worried about, you're just making them worse by not addressing it the way that we need to address it. So how do we do that? How do we also alternatives to incarceration, which I know is something that interests you, you know, instead of caging people, what can we do?
Right.
As I said before, this isn't a question of removing accountability, right? And people within the abolition movement often like, oh, what are you just going to let everybody do? And no, there's, of course, you have to have accountability if you want people to treat others without harm happening, right, in all of its different ways, then of course there has to be accountability when somebody does something wrong. Must happen. But caging someone, you know, the postulation is that caging someone is not the way to do that, and that there are alternatives. There's all sorts of different programs that exist around the country, around the world, where instead of putting someone in a cage, how do you get people to a place where they can find that stability, have that accountability, find that stability, but then also, you know, not destabilize the community, not destabilize their family. So alternatives to incarceration, finding out more about what alternatives to incarceration exist in your community and how to support them, how to not, you know, NIMBY it, right? Not in my backyard, how to not make it like, oh, well, I don't want it here. Again, with our neighborhood, right? We have a sober house, I think, down the street, right?
And there was a big push against it because it was going to ruin the neighborhood.
Which,
and it's
obviously
been here for 5 years and it's fine.
Actually, like, they've done a beautiful job.
That house is lovely now.
Gorgeous. Yeah. They just did some landscaping. You know, I'm thrilled to have that in my community, right? Yeah. And we need to help people. I know people are scared.
Yeah.
Right? It's scary. We've been trained from basically infancy to worry about crime, right?
Mm.
My students are justice studies majors because they've been watching NCIS and SVU and Law and Order, right? These shows have been around forever, teaching us to be afraid of so-called criminals. Even the news, right? I mean, the news terrifies us about the other.
Yeah.
Because it gets us to spend money, right? So just helping people understand that maybe don't have to be afraid, and that there are ways that that we can address these issues in the community. And then on a bigger level, you know, sort of making it so that abolition isn't such a scary word, which is, I think, a good place for hope, because, you know, abolition isn't something that people talked about, you know, in public that much, you know, that long ago.
Right.
So that, you know, now that we're talking about, okay, what is another way to be? I always recommend, I'm a broken record about Mariam Kaba, but I always recommend Mariam Kaba's work. She has a Transform Harm website, which is just wonderful, talking about like, okay, what would it mean? Dean Spade does work in this area as well. What would it mean to have a world without prisons? And how could we transform our world to, you know, reduce harm? You know, but also not cage people. Dean Spade talks a lot about mutual aid, for example, as being something. I don't actually remember whether I talked about mutual aid in the book. I don't think so. But it's been emerging quite a lot more recently. The Barnard Center for Research on Women is doing something soon on mutual aid and how we can sort of create communities that support each other.
Well, I always find conversations about mutual aid funny because as it's like described to me, I'm like, isn't that church? Like, you know, like, well, I mean, or it's what it's supposed to be. Yeah. So
nice wrap up.
That's my reading this book. I'm like, okay, so where does church fit into this and that chart of success? Like, what are the places that we plug in to do this work that Jesus was talking about? Right. Yes. And I think there's, you know, some of the other pieces that I didn't bring up were like, you know, like Jesus gets criticized all the time for hanging out with sex workers, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's just in and of itself, it's like creating a different understanding of community and who we're supposed to be in community with. Yes. Right. I think you talk a lot in one section in this book about protecting women. Yes. Right. Like there's that whole instead of being punitive against women, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's that whole incident where the community is getting ready to throw stones at a woman and kill her because she committed adultery, right? Or whatever. Like, and who knows whether or not that was consensual, because there were very different understandings of that back then. And funny that she gets blamed and the dude doesn't. But so here are all these people going to throw the stones, and Jesus is like, hold up. Like, you know, if anybody here has never done anything wrong, throw that stone. And everybody's like, ugh. So I think there's definitely some clear like moral imperatives for us to do this work. A more recent example that we've been connected to, we're involved in Congregations Organized for New Connecticut, Connect, which is an interfaith community organizing group. And they did a lot of work, because we're part of it, did a lot of work advocating for clean slate legislation.
Yes.
Right? Like, is that,
James,
you know, we're talking about both the individual intervention, right? Yes. Supporting this person.
Yes.
And I think churches get stuck in that individual a lot. Yes. But you're in sort of talking about the systemic level, right?
Yes.
Here is this legislation that was passed that, for those who don't know what it is, you know, wipes the slate clean slate after a certain amount of time, so that when you apply for housing, when you apply for jobs, your criminal, you know, misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies are, oh, you got some sirens going by, blessings on whatever is happening there.
QED.
Yeah. Before the slate is wiped clean, right? Like your history, your record appears on any application and sort of is that wall you were talking about, right?
Yep.
So the idea behind this legislation is like people need a second chance, right? Need the opportunity to re-enter into society. They need housing, right? Yeah. That's the matrix, housing and jobs and
if
family.
You're gonna, right? If you're going to leave them unable to have a place to live that's safe, if you're going to leave them unable to get jobs, if you're going to leave them unable to afford an education, if you're gonna, like, then what do you think people are going to do?
Yeah.
You know, I understand people wanting to punish. I do desperately understand people wanting to punish people who've done something wrong. I get it. But unless you want them to keep doing it, we have to set people up for success. We have to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yes, where does the church lie in that? I think, yes, you're right. Absolutely helping individuals, right? If you've got a soup kitchen or if you've got, you know, ways to sort of do that direct aid to individuals and to their families. Absolutely. But yes, making policy changes, there's so many very obvious policy changes that can be made. And I mean, many years ago now, at this point, I mean, Michael Jacobson, a professor of mine from CUNY, but also formerly the Commissioner of Corrections for New York, he wrote a book where he focused on the fact that we have a moment where this is the issue where people from both sides of the political spectrum can come together.
Yeah.
Because the criminal justice system as it is, mass incarceration, the prison industrial complex, indeed, is way too expensive.
Yep.
We cannot afford it.
Yep.
And we are affording it at the expense of all of these other things that we want very much to do.
Yeah.
And that if we weren't spending the money on caging people ineffectively, in a way that's counterproductive, and they keep going back and back and back and back and back, and we keep sending all of our taxpayer dollars to corporations, right, or to the state where they just pay for probation, right? It just becomes this crazy circle, right? So the people on the more conservative side of the spectrum have a reason to break down the prison industrial complex. And people on the more sort of liberal or progressive side of this political spectrum don't want this because it's not humane and it's not something that works. You know, we can come together and be like, hey, this whole system isn't working for either of us. What can we do? Fine, you've got the correctional officers unions and they're not going to want to see this around. But other than that, pretty much everybody agrees this isn't working for them. And corporations want it, right? Which is should be our bellwether to say, like, wait a second, maybe this isn't the way we should be doing things, right? Multinational corporations are like, this is making us billions. Keep it going, right? We keep needing to wash the sheets, and we keep needing to provide nasty food, and we keep needing to, you know, do all of these different things, providing phone calls, providing commissary, providing all these things, and we're making tons of money off of it. So leave it alone.
Yeah.
You know, fight amongst yourselves, please.
Yeah,
while we make our money.
Well, and I am so appreciative of this conversation because you just said everybody agrees this isn't working. And yet for those of us who don't have direct contact with that system for various reasons, whether it's the choices we've made or the privilege we've inherited, I don't think we realize how much it's not working.
Yes.
And so thank you for your research. Thank you for your writing. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for the 5 other episodes that we've planned out from this conversation, because there are a lot of topics. Thank you for the work you do also that I didn't name in the beginning, advocating for special ed students in our community and some of the trainings you've done. On how, you know, our local officers can better understand how to approach students and how schools can better support those students. So, yeah. I mean, you're just doing a lot of things that are important for the world. So I'm honored to know you and so grateful for your time today.
It's wonderful talking to you.
Yeah. Blessings. Thank you.